All right, welcome back to the Common Man Podcast. Today I have Miles Wakeham here today. How are you doing, Miles?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
All right, I'm very appreciate, you know, for being able to be on the podcast today. I see you have a very interesting story. I'd like to get started, you know, talking about where you're from, and also I'm interested in learning more about this accident that happened that kind of changed your life. And we'll get into that.
Yeah, sure. My accent probably gives it away, but I'm originally from Australia. Was born and bred there. By the age of 25, I was sick of the place and I had to get out. So I found myself on a plane and landed in California and met a girl and got married and ended up staying there and spent the last 30 years of my life as an American, and only recently just exited that, and now I'm in central Mexico of all places. So yeah, I get around a bit. I guess I grew up as my parents were concert musicians, concert pianists. I grew up as a classical musician at the age of 5. I had a violin under my chin. At the age of 11, I was in the Junior Symphony Orchestra in South Australia. So I spent, it was an unusual schooling. I didn't have that traditional, you know, reading, writing, mathematics kind of background. But that's fine. It worked out all right for me. I got through to high school and then discovered, other than learning, you know, rock guitar and all these other styles, I ended up discovering computers and technology and found myself writing software on some of the very first ever computers that ever were personal computers that ever came out in the 70s. And that turned into a career as a software developer. Started software companies when I was 17. And by the age of 25, I'd written software for defense contractors, attorney general's departments, big cryogenic freezer storage facilities, big transport companies like the equivalent of like FedEx, that sort of thing. And I was a kid. I thought I knew it all. Didn't know squat. I ended up on a plane, came to California. Couldn't work. Immigration wouldn't let me. So I went back to music and ended up in Hollywood, joined a band. Band we did pretty good. Ended up becoming a recording engineer, of all things. And then worked, you know, through Hollywood in the 90s. Recorded a lot of big bands and stuff like that. And then I got a phone call one day that my mother had a car accident. I had to leave California, went back to Australia, ended up having to stay there. She was in pretty bad shape, and got a divorce, which was not good. And then one day I was asked by some friends if I wanted to go on a vacation to the other side of the country. I said, sure, had nothing better to do. And it was a two-day drive. And on the way back, on the second day, we had a massive car accident in the outback. And it's nasty. I won't go into details, but my friend's girlfriend was killed, and I was crushed in the car and disabled and the whole bit, in a coma for about 12 days. And came out of that, basically lost the use of one of my arms and could barely walk. And then found that there was no financial support from medicine and all the stuff that you would expect to have. There was all these loopholes that these insurance companies got out of, and I was left holding the bag. So anyway, I picked myself up, dusted myself off, and realized that I'm not going to sit there playing pity potty all day. I'm just going to get back to work and try and make a go of what I've got left. Then eventually got remarried and then found myself back on a plane back to California again. And there was no music industry left when we got back. Napster had destroyed it all. So I went back into software development and spent the last 20 years doing that and did pretty well out of it. But did everything the polar opposite of what everybody told me to do, because I guess, you know, on the other side of the planet, growing up when I did, there weren't rules and expectations, and you didn't have to have a degree or anything. I didn't even finish high school. Right. But I've made millions multiple times. I've lost it many times. Thankfully, right now I'm in a good place, which is good. But yeah, that's kind of a whole roller coaster journey that got me to where I am today.
Wow, yeah, it's such an amazing story, and how you became a self-made, right? Self-made millionaire and doing all of your ventures and things like that. What did you learn most about like the medical industry? And I see you've done, you said you've gone to multiple different countries for surgeries and things like that. Mm-hmm. What did you learn the most?
Well, it's funny because I worked in the medical industry as a software developer. I was one of the very early software developers at this little startup in Thousand Oaks called Amgen that became the world's largest biotech. So I kind of witnessed a company going from just a few dozen guys in lab coats to a big corporation. And I could see that was very early on. And when I saw that up close and personal, I realized that the people who really wanted to make a difference, you know, the gene cutters, the guys who really knew what they were doing, their heart was in the right place. The problem is the second that Wall Street sort of took them over, it all of a sudden, you know, they could have cured cancer, but nobody could fund it because they couldn't see a profit motive out of it or something. I mean, it was ridiculous. Mm. Everything kind of became, this is something that even to this day, which, you know, I kind of can sort of square the circle, I guess. Everything in Australia where I grew up, it's a big country with a few people in it. I mean, it's a massive place. And everybody kind of looks after each other like a small town, even though it's a big, you know, it's got big cities and whatever. It still has that sort of attitude. And, you know, doing things in good faith and ethics and morality is really important down there. If you do something wrong, you'll wear it. Somebody will call you out and you don't want them to do that. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the States, when I arrived, I was kind of a, you know, babe in the woods because that doesn't work in the US. In the US, everything's transactional. It's like all about what can you do for me today? This kind of your value to society. And it's all about making money. And I kind of looked at that whole thing and I saw it in medicine, right? I mean, I saw it working in the middle of that industry. And then the funny thing is that, you know, when I had my accident and I came out with all of these medical problems and couldn't get the medical care in my own home country for it, when I arrived back into the States, I was a pre-existing condition all over. No insurance company would touch me. Mm. So everything I had to do, I had to pay for myself. And that's when you start seeking out, you know, other places that are cheaper. And you start realizing that, like, south of the border in Mexico, where I am now, it's 12 times cheaper for everything, from pharmaceuticals to medical care to hospitals. And all of a sudden it's like, hey, this is really affordable. I can pay cash and get the best doctors looking after me and I can afford it. I couldn't do that in LA. The price differential is a barrier. And so people get sick in the States because they don't take care of themselves and they're given a chance, you know, to go and have a hip replacement or whatever you need. No one can afford to take time off work or pay for it. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But you fly a couple of hours south of the border and they'll do it to, you know, $4,000 and you walk away and it's the best medical experience you ever had. And that was kind of how it worked out for me. So I've done it. My wife has done it too. She just had surgery here in Mexico and it's been great. And I've got nothing but good things to say about it.
Do you think it's different for people who grew up here, you know, in the terms of being an entrepreneur or going to school, trying to be a success, than someone coming outside of the country and maybe emigrating in?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think there's a different perspective on things from that. I noticed that the US is a huge transactional economy. It's the biggest economy in the world. And so if you ever want a place to find opportunity to make money, this is the place. The problem is, can you keep it? Because everybody else is out there trying to take it from you so that you can't get to keep it. So, you know, Forbes magazine will publish that 78% of people in the United States are living paycheck to paycheck. They've got more month than money.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. And, you know, no one ever measures that. Everyone likes flexing about how much money they make or what their salary is, all this sort of stuff. But most people can't keep the money they earn. They end up in debt even though they make $200,000. And it's like, well duh. Okay, so maybe the way to do it, make your money in the States and spend it somewhere else. Which is kind of what I do. But you know, be a global citizen first. I mean, it's one thing to be a patriot of your country and be a national citizen, but you know, for me, that was a long time ago. And you start traveling around the world, you start realizing that you're a global citizen. You're not a citizen of any one country. And so you make your money where you can and you spend it where it's going to be the best value. And that's how you get to keep it. That's how you get to keep most of it.
Well, what would you say to someone, maybe a family that's living paycheck to paycheck? What's the first step that they can do towards, you know, financial stability?
Own your problems, right? Start there. Okay. I'm not going to make any friends saying this, but you're fucked up. Excuse the language. But the truth is, really, if you were 18, went and took a student loan on something that you had no idea for the rest of your life that you were actually going to do that thing, and yet you went into debt for $100,000, I got no pity for you. Mm. None. That's stupid. You could have gone to Finland and had an education for free, or Germany. If you were willing to do it, you would have had the experience of going around the world and seeing different places and learning to exist in a language, in a country that doesn't speak your native language. And those challenges will last for the rest of your life. You'll find yourself, you'll find your center, you'll have the confidence, you won't live in anxiety, and then you'll get your education. It won't cost you anything, or very, very little. You'll come back with a degree, and I guarantee that Indeed.com and all the other sites will accept it just fine. Mm-hmm. And then you'll get your job at American Express and realize, I don't want to work for the man anymore. And then you'll have the freedom to be able to say, I don't want to work for the man. I'm going to quit. Because I have no debt, right? Yeah. That's where it starts.
That's the crazy thing is, you know, when an 18-year-old maybe graduates high school, the next thing to do is to take a student loan, right? To go to a school maybe near them or maybe out of state. But no one really thinks that it's possible to go to another country to go to school there. Or maybe, you know, maybe we don't know if it's better in the U.S. or if a different country. Or I see everyone else. My friends are taking loans as well. You know, maybe I start working and I don't go to school and I take a year off, but then I get an auto loan because I need a car because I need to get to work. And then now you're in with an auto loan and you're in debt and you have expenses and maybe you can't go back to school right away. So it's like, it's crazy how things work. It's like, if they don't understand, and you know, how can people learn? And I think it sucks.
Well, I mean, look, if you want to get the same results as everybody else, which, to be honest, suck. Yeah. It's not good. Do the opposite. Don't do what they do. And when everyone looks at you and thinks you're the oddball, you're the outcast, you're the idiot, you'll be an idiot going all the way to the bank. Seriously. The bottom line is that we live in a society which has been completely swindled, completely hypnotized by the banking class. From the age of 18, you can go and get a $100,000 student loan, but you can't go into a bar and buy a beer in most states. That's weird. Mm-hmm. Right. They trust you to go into debt for six figures, but not to drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. I don't get it. And then after that, okay, fine. Then you got to pay it off, but you can't get out of it if you fall on hard times. There's no bankruptcy protection for that. You're stuck with it. And it's a setup. I mean, it's an absolute setup. I put my daughter into college and she graduated about 4 or 5 years ago. And what I noticed was this promise of education, of tertiary education, of something that I never had myself, right? That promise was completely flawed. The first 2 years of her education was about the college experience. It was about adjusting to dorm life and adjusting to general knowledge and all this sort of stuff. It's like, well, what did she go to high school for? That's where she got all that. She doesn't need to be retaught the same thing she already knows. She literally paid for a 4-year education that really was two. She got 2 years of actual studying her major. I mean, that's not right. That's bad value for money. Right. And then what concerns me is that if we're relying on the best and brightest to be able to keep our country number one out there, and let's face it, they're competitors, how are you going to get them when you've only got 2 years for a bachelor's degree? Mm-hmm. You're forcing them to go into a post-grad and then maybe a doctorate to come out the same level that somebody in Taiwan came out after 2 years of their university. Wow. So, I mean, it doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah. And then I think, now I hear a lot that a bachelor's degree doesn't even do it anymore for a lot of the companies. They're looking for a master's or some sort of specialization, right?
Yeah. But the truth is, I think if you come out of college, like most people, you probably realize when you finish, 65% of people don't follow a career path that's based on the major they did in college. Mm-hmm. That's scary. Mm-hmm. But if you are in that 35% that do, you go out in there, maybe you did a degree that was required for certification. So you're a doctor or you're an engineer or a lawyer or something like that. I get that. But if you're doing a degree that's not based on certification, then you've got to look at it and say, well, when I leave college and I go into the workforce, what skills am I bringing? Well, zero. Mm. Because you haven't done anything yet. You've learned, academically how something's supposed to work. But until the rubber meets the road and you hit the ground and you actually got that first job, that's when you start learning. So to put all your money and your debt load into that previous 4 years, which really is 2 years of education, and to carry that debt forward, it's not going to work. And anybody, look, if you've got somebody at the age of 18 listening right now, your parents probably hate me. But the truth is, go and spend 2 years traveling around the world first.
Yeah.
Get that out of your system. Go and back, live in a hostel in London or be a bartender in Tokyo or whatever it takes. Go and do whatever it takes. You'll have the best experience of your life. You'll meet the most important people you'll ever meet. You'll see opportunities that nobody else will see. And then when you come back, you might know something about yourself. And then that will help you determine a path, a direction. And at that point, if you're absolutely committed to that, the investment in tertiary education, if required for that path, may make sense. But you might find, I didn't need it. I enjoy being an oil rigger in Iceland or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I saw that you didn't go to high school, right? Or you didn't graduate high school. But no. Did you go back to college? Did you go to college?
No. Okay. I never did, and I never intend to. I mean, I got into computers at the time when there were no college education for computer science in Australia in the 70s. I had to pull the thing apart with a soldering iron and a multimeter and work out how the thing worked and then build one. I mean, that was my education. I did it in a bedroom, with a book, and there wasn't even the internet. So, you'd go to the library, you'd work out the basics of electronics and you'd just sort of work it out.
Yeah.
And that's very much an Australian thing because we're also on the other side of the planet and there wasn't too many people that would go down there, because it was so far. So the buck stopped at our desk. We had to work it all out. And that's part of problem solving skills that you have to develop.
That's what I was going to ask is, have you always had that mindset of like, I'm going to get this done. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to learn somehow, some way.
But I'm not unique in that. Most of the people from my generation in Australia, particularly, it sucks when, you're living in bushfire country or sharks or everything on the ground that's creeping and crawling is going to kill you. And, that's the world we're raised in. We're very self-reliant. We have to be or we die. It's that simple.
Wow.
So if you come from that kind of world, it changes your perspective. You realize risk reward. You realize that there's no reward without risk, and you've got to learn to mitigate risk and dance with it. And that's part of what we learn. Once you have that knowledge, you get it very young in life in Australia. But once you get that knowledge, it lets you see things differently and not be scared of things. You realize everything has got risk and you just have to learn to mitigate it. You have to learn to balance things and that's, just life. That's how it is.
Yeah. And that brings me to my next question. Speaking of risk and mitigation, you were early in on cryptocurrency, I see. And it sounds like you took a similar approach, the risk, the mitigation, but like what made you such an early adopter? Like how did you hear about it? What made you get in? Like, how did you buy your first, coin? When I know back then it was not as easy as you can do now when you sign into Coinbase or something and buy Bitcoin. So yeah, what was that story like?
That's a weird one for me because I didn't, I wasn't one of these people that would sort of watch, YouTube videos about Bitcoin and all that stuff because, well, it wasn't really anything. I used to like playing video games. And in the early 2000s, when the first massively multiplayer role-playing games all came out, like World of Warcraft and stuff like that, I would love that idea. I loved getting involved in those games, and I spent way too much time playing them, only to realize that there was this thing where in this virtual world you could invest time and you would, I don't know, craft a sword or find a chest after spending hundreds of hours trying to do something to get some sort of reward. And it was fascinating that right about the middle of the 2000s, there were a few guys who started realizing that there was all this cheap labor in Asia, particularly in China, who would sit there and play the games for you and get all of those, the loot, and then you could actually pay them real money and they'd meet you in some virtual bar somewhere and give you the loot.
That's crazy.
And I was, yeah, and I was fascinated with this fusion between real world economics and virtual world goods. And I thought we're entering a time when goods don't have to be physically tangible. Like I don't have to be able to touch something in order to feel that it had value. So, you know, that was not always a thing. Back in the 80s and 90s, you bought something, you went and saw it, right? You wanted to buy a computer, you'd go to the store and you'd sit and you'd bang on the keyboard. And that's kind of important, but Dell changed the game when they started to have for the first time like websites where you could like put in the spec of what you wanted and they'd build it for you and then send it to you sight unseen and you'd hand over thousands of dollars. And I looked at society and thought, who on their right mind would give thousands of dollars for something that they don't physically see or touch, you know? That they did. They did. Michael Dell was very wealthy from that. And I looked and thought, well, maybe we're reaching a time in culture when people are willing to switch from that old school mentality of I've got to have it in my hands and touch it before I feel like it's got value to it doesn't really matter. It's what it does for me. And when video games, that was a big thing. So the reason why that's important is that there was this concept of being able to take physical money and convert it to like credits or whatever the game currency was. And they had these things called exchanges. And one of the, there were a number of them, but one of the biggest one was an exchange out of Japan called NT Gox, or which was Magic the Gathering Online Exchange, because that used to be a game. It was like cards and video games.
Sort of I heard it referred to as, Mountain Gox or something like that. That I didn't know. I didn't realize Magic the Gathering. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was an exchange where people who play video games would exchange real money for tokens in the game and then bought their virtual goods with them. And MT Gox, you know, they weren't really regulated or anything. They were just a thing out of Japan. But they started to trade in other things like cryptocurrency. When 2009, the Bitcoin white paper came out, if you wanted to buy Bitcoin, I mean, back in the early days, I mined it. You know, you could have a laptop, you could mine 100 Bitcoin. It was crazy.
Wow.
Imagine that now.
Yeah.
But back then, if you didn't have the time or energy to wait around to mine the coins, you could go to MT Gox and you could wire them. You actually like physically wired money from a bank to them. And then they give you an account, credit you for the money that was received, less their fees. And then you'd spend it to buy Bitcoin or, I don't know, gold in World of Warcraft or whatever it was that you wanted to spend. So I bought some Bitcoin. I also was a countryman from my era was Julian Assange, and I'd been not working with him, but watching what he was doing in the very early days of WikiLeaks and so on, and the whole concept of cryptographic security, which was a big part of the technology world I was living in. And one day I watched as he had, I don't know, unveiled something somebody didn't like. And the next thing you know, every bank dropped him, PayPal dropped him, Western Union dropped him. No one could donate to keep his servers running. And he went public and said, there's this new thing called Bitcoin. And if you want to send me some Bitcoin, it'll help keep the servers running. And I thought, well, hey, you know, I've got some Bitcoin on that MT Gox here. I'll send you some. And that worked out really well. And what I could see was the speed of the transaction. It was so fast. Wow. So this was changing. This was a game changer. So it, I went down the rabbit hole on it. And as it happened, there was, I was always like curious, like, how do you take this virtual currency? Like, I went from physical money, like wired it and got virtual. How do I go back the other way? Right. Mm-hmm. How can I get money back? There was this company out of Hong Kong. I can't even think of their name. They were the first company that ever created a Bitcoin exchange and a Visa debit card. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, ah, there's the answer. So I moved all of my money out of MT Gox to this exchange in Hong Kong. And 2 weeks later, MT Gox got hacked and everyone lost all their money. So I got lucky. I mean, dodged a bullet, right? Wow. But I'm just holding everything in Bitcoin and then watching Bitcoin go to like from, you know, $7 or something I bought it for to $1,200.
Yeah. Like,
what? And that just started everything. And then I never left the crazy town of cryptocurrency. I've been in it ever since.
Wow. What is your opinion on these other altcoins like Dogecoin or things like that? Is it just more like Bitcoin is like the gold standard?
Well, I mean, you know, look, if anybody's willing to pay money for something, then it's got some value, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter if it's tulips or if it's Ethereum mm-hmm. or if it's Dogecoin or Bitcoin. The question really comes down to what has the greatest level of faith behind it. And I guess that's really a decision that only the individual can make. For me, I'm just happy with Bitcoin. It works and it's good and it's been solid. But it goes through cycles, like mm-hmm. all things go through cycles. But it has a limited supply. And I think that's one of the critical things is that you can't manipulate the price all that much. Sure, you can if there's a lot of demand for it, but the fact that there's a limited supply is the reason why it's, you know, going up so fast in price right now. But mm-hmm. there's no guarantees in life, right? If everybody right. decides it's the spawn of the devil and no one wants it, it'll be worth nothing because nobody wants to buy it, so it won't have any value. Basic free market economics, supply and demand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a cool story, though. I love that how you got into that and it piqued my interest. But I wanted to ask you why you decided to purchase land in Mexico. You know, what are you building there? And then what advice do you have for someone to get started in real estate?
I've been doing real estate a very long time, many decades. It's actually because of real estate that we ended up buying it here in Mexico. I guess after 30 years of being in the States and feeling like I went there and really my passion was in music. My passion was in recording and Hollywood and all that stuff. And, when I couldn't go back to it because Napster kind of destroyed the entire music industry and record labels didn't make records anymore. So it didn't, you know, it wasn't the same world. It was kind of disappointing because I felt like I got a taste of it. You know, for about 7-8 years, I lived in that world and it was like, great. I loved it. I wanted to go back to that. And I realized that in the United States, it's not likely to come back anymore. I'd spent 20 years feeling like I was kind of selling myself out to a lot of, you know, rich guys who'd pay me money to write software for them that would hopefully make them richer. Mm-hmm. And I did that, you know, many times. And along the way, I'd pick up a bit of Bitcoin here, or I'd pick up a bit of real estate there, and all of a sudden, those things started to have real value. Well, I think at some point, you kind of question, what am I doing? Like, why am I here? I got one life, and I'm not getting any younger, and I wanted to follow my passion. And when I was, you know, in my 20s, I did. And I had no fear, and it was wonderful. And it wasn't because of a lack of interest or doing it. It was because of external events that I had no control over that changed my course. I kind of wanted to put my course back together again, but I realized that, you know, this is a different world now. but I still felt, you know, the thing that probably really, so two things happened that sort of switched me off the tech world. One was the consolidation of all these technology startups into big Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, when I started, a kid in the garage could actually build Apple because they did, right? Like me, I built my own software company. Bill Gates did his. Yeah, they had really good results with theirs. But back in those days, you could do that.
Yeah.
Right? It was there were no rules. You know, we were the first guys through the door. And it was wonderful. And you could do that probably up until about the internet. When the internet startups all start occurring, it's the same thing. It was kids in their garage writing websites or, you know, whatever. When mobile phone technology came out, it was the same thing. People mm-hmm. could write their own apps. It was great. But we haven't had those days for a long time. Now everything you've got to sign up and be on some huge cloud platform, or you've got to work for Facebook or Google to be able to pay the rent. I mean, it just isn't the same world. And then the worst part about that, I thought, was this the natural kind of acceleration of technology through things like Moore's Law, which is the fact that every 18 months the technology is basically twice as fast, twice as powerful for the same price. So if you know and can predict these kind of cycles, you typically end up in a world where you can say, well, you know, I know roughly this stuff's going to get to a point where it's so powerful, it's more powerful than we are. And I think we hit that magic point maybe a year or two ago with the whole AI thing coming out.
Yeah.
And it's not going to go, you can't put that genie back in the bottle, right? It's not going to go anywhere other than further control. It's a technology which, you know, to buy like a single server with NVIDIA hardware to do this sort of thing, it's like a $30,000, $40,000 investment. And the data centers in Microsoft and Facebook have thousands of these things. The little guy can't compete. Mm. They can't get a foot in the door to do it. And so at some point, we're all going to end up working for those big tech companies because they're the only ones who have got any work. Why? You know, the AI has already taken over the transport industry or the, you know, accounting industry or all these other industries. So what's people going to do? What work for the man? Is that going to be the way the world is? This consolidation scares the crap out of me. I wanted to go back to where I came. Like I wanted to go back to organic, buck stops here, nature, you know, music, art. I wanted to go back to those things, the things I grew up with in Australia. And I know it was a different time and a different place, but those things made me who I was, who I am. And I didn't think that I was ever going to develop into anything if I'm going to let ChatGPT do all the work.
Yeah.
And it's not that, you know, it's not that it doesn't do good work, but is that what I really want as a human? Is that my experience? I mean, at some point we don't look after ourselves enough. You know, we're human beings first and foremost. We're not subjects of, you know, flashing lights and blips, you know, and that this gadget sort of, you know, mentality. Yeah, it's fun for a little while, but at some point it's like, don't we lose ourselves? And, you know, here's the weird thing. You go to Mexico, it's like you went back in time 100 years. You know, really? The streets are still horrible and crappy and full of stones and, you know, cobblestones, and they're made for horses, not cars, and the buildings were built in the 1500s, and, you know. And so there's so much to complain about. And then you say all the crime because the poverty levels, they're so extreme from rich to poor and so on. But the truth is people here, they're all about family. They're all about good food. They're about art, music, and painting, and theater. They're about community, about looking after each other. And I kind of like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, for me, it brings me back to being a human again. And my wife is also from Australia. She felt it too. And between the two of us, we're like, oh, my God, we found our place. Everybody looks at you and goes, why do you move to that place? They're going to, that cartel will behead you or whatever. It's like, I don't hang with them. You know, they don't go to the restaurants I go to. At least I don't think they do. And you know, life is good here. I'm pretty happy.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. So did you like vacation there, or like you visited there and you're like, you wanted to buy a plot of land or something? And what are you building there now?
Well, we live, when we're in the States, we live in Arizona and Phoenix. Mm. And so Mexico, Sonora is just part of our normal connection because, you know, it's an hour and a half down the road. And that meant that you would cross the border and see another culture that didn't speak your native language, and you'd start realizing, well, I'm an immigrant to the United States. I'm no different being an immigrant to Mexico. So I can traverse the border. I don't really even see a border. I just go in and out of it, like the birds. And so why not? If I want tacos, you know, I can go and buy them in Tucson. That's great. Or I can go and buy them in Hermosillo and get really good tacos. You know, it's like, it's just a choice. I think we started with that. We started with the typical experience of like hanging out at the beaches and drinking 50 cent cervezas and, you know, the whole bit. And then that just turned into looking deeper at the culture and the history and really trying to respect something which was far older than my history, you know, the country I came from, and really understanding, you know, its story. And it was just fascinating to us. So we ended up going further, deeper into central Mexico. We found this town called San Miguel de Allende, which is right in the center. And it just so happened it's got a lot of expats here. So there are a lot of people that speak English, which helps a bit because my Spanish is going to get better, but it's pretty appalling. I mean, I can order food and, you know, and get through the transactional day, but that's about it. But anyway, we found this place. We loved it. And we were looking at buying a house, and we found this beautiful home in this awesome area that was near the lake. It was just great. And we stupidly said, let's wait until we get back to the States, try and get our affairs, you know, our money in order. There's no mortgages in Mexico, right? You pay cash. So we'd have to liquidate something to pay for this property we found. So it was going to take a little bit of time. I got back a couple of days working with my banker and said, you know, can you loan us money against one of our rental properties or something? He said, sure. Then I called my agent back and I said, okay, that property we saw where Reed make an offer. He goes, sorry about that, mate. It got sold. I'm like, damn it. So anyway, you know, a month or so goes by, you dust yourself off and you're like, let's go back and have another look. So we flew back, had another look, and it just so happened across the street there was this big property, like an acre, that was had these really high, like 30-foot high walls around it. And I said to my agent, I said, what's that? He goes, oh, it's a matador school. It's got a bullfighting ring in it, a full-size one. I'm like, are you kidding? He goes, yeah, the lady who owns it, her husband used to be one of the leading matador trainers in Mexico, but he died in 2012. And she's kept this property around as kind of like a tribute to him, right? And it just so happens that my real estate agent knows her quite well. So a few days go by and I get a phone call and he goes, yeah, I just had lunch with Nina, the lady who, you know, owns this property. She'd like to sell it.
Oh,
I'm like,
wow.
What? I'm like, what, a bullfighting ring? So we go down there, we check it out. Yeah, it's for real. It's a real bullfighting ring. And I said, well, okay, I guess nobody else is going to buy this, but unless you're a matador, you probably can't use it.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, she, you know, and she had a really fair price. And I said to my wife, what do you think if we built on this? Like we bulldoze everything, we bring it back down to virgin land and we build on it. She's like, you up for that? I'm like, look, I'm getting out of this stupid technology career. I got nothing else to do right now. Of course I'm up for it. So we did. We bought it. And this was happening. It's a funny story, but it was happening about the same time that I discovered how cheap surgery was in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I still had this problem with my shoulder, like, you know, from this car accident. And I'd had it for 25 years. And I thought, I'm going to live with this for the rest of my life. So I was in San Miguel and having mezcal with somebody, a friend of mine who happened to be a doctor, and I told him about, you know, this shoulder thing. And he goes, well, you should go and see this guy. And he gives me this name of a guy in Guadalajara who's an orthopedic surgeon. Let him have a look. All right. I said, well, why not? So we get in the bus and we go to Guadalajara and we go into this guy's office and he looks it over and he gets, you know, x-rays and the whole bit. And then eventually an MRI, which I thought there's no way I can afford an MRI. They're like $4,000 in the States, $200 in Mexico. Same machine, same stuff, right? So down the road I go, get an MRI, come back. He puts all the stuff on his computer and up on the wall and everything. And he's looking, he's going, oh my God, this, you know, your shoulders. I said, yeah, I know. It was like patched up by a NASH unit. It wasn't, you know, I said, can you do anything? And he goes, yeah, I can completely rebuild it. I'm like, okay.
Oh, wow.
How much? And I'm like, oh, here we go. Drum roll, please. You know, and he gives me this massive number. Right. And I'm like, oh my God. How much is this? Like, you know, 200,000 something. And I'm thinking, I got a quote from UCLA. It was like 165 grand or something to get this done in California. And he goes, yeah, it's probably about 200. That's pesos. I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, pesos about 20 to 1.
Oh,
I said, how much is that in US dollars? He gets a calculator out and he's like, you know, 9,000 bucks. I'm like, Doc, sign me up right now. So he did. So anyway, I got the surgery, right? So I'm now stuck in Guadalajara. I can't leave there for a month. My wife's with me. We got an Airbnb, so we're just hanging out. You get bored, right? You got nothing to do. So I took one of those little portable set-top boxes, like Android TV boxes or whatever, with me and plugged in the HDMI cord and the TV and the Airbnb, and I'm just sitting there watching YouTube videos all day. And, you know, I stumble upon all this music stuff. So I used to work in this recording studio in Hollywood called Grandmaster Recorders. It was a real shithole. It smelled of urine. It was in a really bad gang infested area, but it was famous because Stevie Wonder recorded there and the Black Crowes recorded there. And when I was working in there, I think Tool were working in there. It was like a lot of really big name acts that at the time you wouldn't have known. But it was just this wonderful studio. It had a beautiful big Neve console and it was like I learnt my craft in there. So I'm watching, you know, YouTube videos and I'm, you know, flipping through and I watched this one about the Foo Fighters, the recording of their second album. And the guy being interviewed is talking about, you know, how they did it and all this sort of stuff. And he goes, yeah, well, he said Dave had written all these songs up in Seattle. And he wasn't really happy with the studio facilities they had up there. So he decided to do what they did with Nirvana. They'd come to LA and find a really cheap, shitty studio and record there. And we recorded in this place called Grandmaster Recorders. And I'm like, oh, my God, I used to be the house engineer there. What the heck? And then I'm looking over this and it's like I'm curious because just before I left my mother had a car accident, so I had to go back to Australia for that. But before that happened, Alan, the guy who owned the place, I remember I was doing a session there and he come downstairs from his office and he said to me, are you available to do a recording session? I've got this band coming in from out of state in like a week and a half or something. Can you do it? And I'm like, yeah, sure, no problem. You know, so put me on the list. So I was supposed to do it. So I didn't realize that was the Foo Fighters. So
oh,
here I am in I'm freaking in Guadalajara and all of a sudden I'm like, and you know, when I looked and I connected the dots of the dates and I'm like, my wife looks at me and my face goes white, right? She goes, oh my God. I'm like, yeah, how do you think of my feel? And she's like, well, what are you going to do about it? I'm like, well, what can I do about it? Come on.
Yeah.
Those days are gone. She goes, no, they're not. I mean, what do you mean? And she goes, listen, you got that, we're going to build that property, right? Yeah. I said, well, how big? It's an acre. It's huge. It's got these big compound walls around it. So she said, well, why don't you build a studio there? And I'm like, well, yeah, okay. I'm going to be able to build a studio there. Yeah, sure. We've got the money. We can do it. So, yeah. So then I'm like, I'm on it. So I start doing this. I built two studios before. So it wasn't my first rodeo, but
nice.
this was going to be big. So I realized, you know, who goes to Mexico to record music, right?
Yeah.
People go to record music. They go to LA or Nashville or New York or something, right? But there was some stories in history about bands particularly in the 80s that had, you know, got these big record label budgets and they ended up going to some far-flung place to record. And I started looking up these stories, and the story of George Martin, the producer of the Beatles, kept coming up. He built a studio in the Caribbean on the island of Montserrat called Air Studios Montserrat. And it was famous because Dire Straits recorded there, Brothers in Arms, Money for Nothing. It was all recorded there. The last two Police albums were recorded there. Elton John recorded there. Paul McCartney recorded there. Rolling Stones recorded there. Rush recorded there. Everybody recorded there. And the studio was destroyed by a hurricane in 1989. And then eventually all chances of bringing it back together again went because there was a volcano on the island that erupted.
Oh, wow.
And it wiped everything out. But the studio was still standing. But you couldn't go there. It was in like this exclusion zone because of all the sulfur and stuff. So, but it was a fascinating story. So I ended up, COVID was happening about then, and I ended up getting on the phone to the Minister of Tourism in Montserrat. And I said, it's really interesting about what you're doing there because what he had was, you know, George Martin passed away in 2017, I think. And, what had actually happened was he built a destination studio, he built a reason for people to want to travel to some far-flung place to record. And so I thought, well, maybe if I could learn from that, I could apply it to my own project. I ended up connected with the people who originally built that studio who were still living on the island, and we became good friends. And the next thing you know, I got hold of the plans, and I said, what if I built that exact studio, like a perfect replica in Mexico? And all these guys who are now, you know, probably in their 70s, 80s, they're not young anymore. They looked at me and they're like, do it. Do it. You have our blessing. Keep the dream alive, dude.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay. So next thing you know, I'm building George Martin's studio in the center of Mexico, and the word's getting out, and be surprised who's following me on Facebook right now.
Wow.
It's nuts, the sort of people that I never thought that I'd be working with are now ready, you know, the second this thing opens, they're on the plane and in the studio. I mean, it's crazy. Wow.
That sounds amazing. That sounds so cool. Are you going to do any, like, promotion or, like, anything – any YouTube videos or things like that? I would love to follow that.
Yeah, I think that's sort of normal. I mean, when you're trying to sell something that's not close by or obvious, you kind of have to explain what it looks like and what it's like to work in there. It wasn't a small endeavor because the gear has to be competitive with any studio in a production city, but we've already got that covered. So, yeah, we will. We'll do videos. We'll do the website, the whole bit. And I'm still not there yet. I mean, I will not be finished with the building until the end of this calendar year. So I'm not going to go out of the gates until I've really got something to show somebody.
Nice.
But it's exciting. It really is. And it's huge. The place is massive. Yeah. Thank you. Well, thank me at the end of the year, right? that'll be the time we'll all go and have a beer.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we kind of wrap up here, where can people find you? And then any final thoughts or advice for young people, you know, maybe wanting to get into real estate or, you know, building a financial life?
Well, firstly, I have a website called beunconstrained.com, and that's where people can find me. They can listen to my podcast. They can do all of that good stuff. By all means, please do. Mm-hmm. Advice. Okay, so I'll leave you with one little story. It'll make it quick. I never finished high school. Okay, I never went to college. I look back now and I think the best lesson I ever got in life was learning how to surf, which is weird. And we Australians, we live by the ocean, so surfing is sort of something we do. But like all teenagers, you don't know what the hell you're doing. So you go out in the ocean with this surfboard you picked up and some used car lot, some used, you know, estate sale or whatever. And you think you know what you're doing and you go out there for day after day after day and you get beaten up, surfboard hits you in the back of the head all the time. You know, you're completely destroyed paddling and you're getting nowhere and it's frustrating. And you see, you know, there's a guy over there and he seems to be catching all the waves and having a great time. It's like, I just want that. Right. Yeah. I just want that. But it's been 3 days and I can't, you know, me and my mates, we'd do this. And then one day I was out there waiting on the board and I started to realize that there were patterns. I could see that waves came in sets. And I could also see that the way to catch them was to be in front of the wave and to start paddling so that you were moving forward a little bit. And it was almost like the wave didn't see you as an adversary. It kind of picked you up and it transferred its energy to you and you rode on it. And I started understanding it's like about synergy, right? It's about becoming at one with the wave. And the wave is just a reflection of the power of the universe because it's just, you know, magnetic cycles that generates the surf and whatever. But this whole pattern of like catching something before it was upon you, but being prepared and paddling as it picked you up and then its power would transfer to you, it worked. And, you know, all of a sudden I was not a great surfer, but I could surf. All of a sudden I was like enjoying myself. It wasn't horrible. But then I realized, you know, that's exactly the same laws that govern the stock market and they govern technology and they govern real estate and they govern cryptocurrency. And they govern everything. If you're ahead of the wave and you paddle, like you engage before it comes upon you, it'll pick you up. And you'll get all the benefit. You'll get all the wealth. Buy low, sell high. That, you know, that basic kind of premise. I'm like, why doesn't anybody do that? It's because what happens is, you know, we think about, oh, okay, say today, I don't know, Bitcoin's at 70-something thousand. You know, who knows what it is when this podcast airs. But I bought it when it was nothing, when nobody wanted it. I bought it when I was in front of the wave, sitting on the board, paddling. When everyone told me don't do that, it's worthless, you know. I'm like, it's not. And then the wave came, picked me up, took me on a ride. I got out at the top before it crashed and enjoyed it. It was great. And then I'll get back on the board, paddle back out and wait for the next wave. And I did the same thing with real estate. When 2008 came about and everybody hated real estate, we bought everything we could at fire sale prices. And 10 years later, sold them all for 11 times what we paid.
Wow.
No debt and just pure millions of dollars of profit. I mean, this is how the world works, right? You get in the front of the wave and you let the wave pick you up and take you. And then if you're getting in low, you don't have a great deal of exposure of risk because your buy-in price was very low. You just have to wait on the board for the wave to come about you and be ready to recognize it and start paddling. That is an education, right? That's, do they teach you that in school? No.
Definitely.
But do you think all those billionaires out there that, you know, own all the big hedge funds and you think they don't know this? Of course they know this, but they're not going to tell you. But some kid in a surfboard can see it with their own eyes if they just open their eyes.
Yeah.
That's what I would leave people with. Be a surfer. Go out there and catch your wave and you won't have to work in that dead-end job for the rest of your life because the wave will transfer its energy and you'll receive it and you'll move forward. It's that simple.
Wow. I love that. Be a surfer. Thank you so much, Miles. Everyone, please go check out beunconstrained.com. Check out his podcast, The Unconstrained Podcast. I was listening to it and I love it already. A lot of great advice, you know, on real estate and other items in there. So thank you again for being on the podcast and I appreciate you.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.